From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
Officially, most EU countries welcome the prospect of Turkish membership, but unofficially, the majority are resisting it. Among the reasons cited for their opposition are doubts about Turkish cultural compatibility with Europe. On this last issue, there's an intense debate in Turkey itself, and nowhere is that clearer than what happened when Elif Shafak's latest novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, was published. It wound up with her in court discussing the whole matter of Turkishness, which to some degree is also one of the subjects of her book, which is published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it brings Elif Shafak to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
One reviewer noted that were he to try to sum up your novel, he would say it's an attack on the very notion underlying the controversy surrounding its publication, the idea of a stable national and cultural identity of a history that can be neatly comprehended and possessed. Do you like that? Do you think that might be true?
Well, I think the book is quite, multi-layered. Definitely that is one of the layers, yeah.
Well, your own life is kind of multi-layered, isn't it? You were born in France, raised in Europe by a Turkish diplomat mother, and these days divide your time between Istanbul, where you teach American literature, and Tucson, Arizona, where you teach in the Near Eastern Studies Department. So is it difficult to navigate such wildly different places?
It is difficult, but at the same time, it's quite enriching, and I think it's very stimulating for my work, for literature. So it's good for writing, but it's a bit difficult for the writer.
Well, you also are writing now in English. This is the second novel you've written in English.
That's right.
And I wonder about that. Orhan Pamuk wrote in his book Istanbul about a past tense in Turkish that doesn't exist in English, that allows the writer to distinguish between hearsay and what he has seen with his own eyes. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, every language has certain things that you gain by using that language and certain things that you lose. So what do you gain by writing in English and then translating it into Turkish? And what would you gain or lose by doing it the other way around?
Absolutely. You see, when I started writing fiction in English, I was bitterly criticized in Turkish, in Turkey, because some people saw it as a cultural betrayal. In Turkey, language is a very politicized issue. However, I never saw it as an either-or choice. You know, are you writing either in English or Turkish once and for all? For me, it's a matter of, you know, there are things that I'd rather write in English. There are some other stories I'd rather write in Turkish. English is not my mother tongue, and I'm a foreigner in this language. I make all sorts of mistakes, and yet at the same time, it's a discovery for me. And that discovery, it's a very existential journey. It's not a linguistic journey only. So I think when it comes to talking about sorrow, the past, you know, I'd rather do that in Turkish. But when I'm dealing with irony, humor, I'd rather do that in English.
Well, this book has a lot of sorrow and talk of the past, and it overflows with characters. How much did you know about what and where they would be when you began?
At the beginning, when I started writing a novel, I do not have the whole story shaped up in my mind. That's not the way I write. Usually I start with a very small idea, a small, you know, feeling, sometimes a rhythm, just a picture, an image, and then the rest follows. I let the story guide me. I let the characters shape themselves. And that's precisely what happened with this book. My starting point was a very simple fundamental duality between memory and amnesia. And I asked myself this question: if the past is gloomy, is it better to know more about it or perhaps it's much better to be future-oriented and just let bygones be bygones.
So we have this this group of women who are living in Istanbul, including Asya. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that name means Asia, if we're about to read that.
That is true.
Who is the bastard of the title.
Yeah.
Her mother had intended to have an abortion. Is abortion common in Turkey?
I wouldn't say it's common, but it is legal, and it's not a major, controversial issue as it is in the States. Sometimes my friends in America are surprised to hear that, but in Turkey, the general feeling is that this is a private matter, and if a woman chooses to have an abortion, probably she has a good reason to do that, because otherwise she wouldn't do it. So people usually respect that private reason, and it's not a public debate.
But this seems to be one of the contradictions of Turkey. We have this country that has this long secular tradition, at least going back to Kemal Atatürk, but even during the Ottoman Empire, it was not like other Muslim
That's
countries.
True.
And then we have people who are fundamentalists, who are very much involved with their group as opposed to other groups, and the growth of religious parties in Turkey to the point where people sue writers over things that they give fictional characters to say in their books.
Well, my experience is Turkey is a mixture of conflicting voices, both conflicting and coexisting. And as you pointed out, when we historically, traditionally, Turkish Islam is quite different than the rest of the Middle East. It's a synthesis. It's a hybrid society in many ways.
But it's Sunni.
Yes.
Except for the Kurds.
Yeah. The Alevis are a minority. But the thing is, let me give you an example about when I look at the story that my book followed. The book came out on the 8th of March, and it was received in a very positive way. To this day, it has remained a major bestseller in Turkey. And the feedback that I received from different segments of Turkish society has been quite positive. It is true that the book has been sued, it has been brought to court, but the number of people who did this is very small, and they do not compose the majority of Turkish society. Sometimes in the Western media, this plurality, this multiplicity that exists in Turkish civil society is forgotten.
Except when the Times runs a photograph of all the many people who came out recently to protest an assassination in Turkey. You get a sense that there are an awful lot of people who are really horrified by
Absolutely.
What's going on.
Absolutely.
So we have these women, three generations of her relations, including crazy Farida, who changes her hairstyles with every shift in her psychiatric diagnosis. But there are no men. The men are either they die young or they leave and they go to America. And that leads to the second family
right.
in the story.
Right. This is a book in which women play the central role, both Armenian and Turkish women. And it's men are, there are very few male characters.
So Mustafa, the brother of Asya's, I guess as Asya's uncle, mm-hmm. went to the United States, and then his Armenian-American stepdaughter mm-hmm. comes back
to Istanbul,
and all of these women, Kazancı women, they express sadness
yeah.
for her family's suffering, but have no sense of Turkish responsibility for it. Would that be typical, or are you making a larger political point?
Well, one thing that intrigues me is to see this difference between how Armenians approach the issue and Turks approach the issue. Usually Armenians, especially Armenians in the diaspora, tend to be very memory-driven and past-oriented. But that's not the case with Turks. We are a very future-oriented society, and we have a huge sense of rupture with our past, with the Ottoman past. It's not only 1915 that we're unable or unwilling to talk about. It's the whole past. And that dilemma between collective amnesia and memory, I think, needs to be taken into account to understand that we're talking two different languages, in fact.
So the past begins with Kemal Atatürk?
Mostly, yeah.
Asya is not only ignorant of her biological origins, the past is at best empty, and at worst she feels an affront to herself.
Right.
So at the same time, she's obsessed with Johnny Cash
right.
and French existentialists.
Right.
Something that probably will also surprise Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They're surprised to see how much, you know, the Western culture, Western literature and music has an impact on young people in Turkey.
She says, if only I could have no past, if only I could be a nobody, start from point zero and just remain there forever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you wrote this, you obviously had to have been aware that you were stirring things up. Do you think that novels should deal with the big social and political issues of the day?
Actually, that wasn't my feeling when I started writing this book. You know, I didn't think I was dealing with very major issues. As I said, my starting point was very, you know, simple, this duality between memory and forgetfulness. I think a novel tells micro stories. I'm telling the story of two families, one Armenian, one Turkish. I'm not telling the stories of masses, of collectivities. A novel usually, in my opinion, a novel has to focus on the micro, the small. Of course, that small reflects major, you know, sometimes major questions, but that wasn't my starting point.
And you have a lot of debates in here. Mm-hmm. You have debates that take place in a bohemian cafe about the nature of Turkishness and something that I get a lot from talking to people from Turkey, an awareness that they are being watched by the West. I mean, there's a
right.
being in the middle somewhere in the Bosporus separates East and West.
Yeah.
In Europe and Asia, but it also does, there's a cultural divide there.
Yeah, Turkey is a very, very interesting country, and it's a mixture of different forces. And Istanbul is a fascinating city in which, you know, traditions and modernity, East and West, everything is pretty much mixed. It is a very, very multi-layered city. So all of this is, it's not easy to digest. And I think many Turks are very much obsessed with their image in the eyes of Westerners. We like to prove to the Western world how Westernized we are. And we are in many ways Westernized. But at the same time, we do have Islamic elements, Eastern elements. And maybe we need to understand that it's not a bad thing to be a mixture, you know, to have this synthesis of different forces.
Well, you include chat room debates. I don't know how many novels have done that, but
right.
chat room debates among Armenians who are as paralyzed by history as the Turks are are ignorant of it.
Right, and I did visit lots of websites while I was writing this novel. It saddened me to see that there are many biases, prejudices about Turks and Turkey. It makes me sad to see this gap between Turks and Armenians, because usually people do not know one another, and it's always easy to make generalizations when you don't know the other. So I came across myriad prejudices on these websites about Turks.
Auntie Banu, who is a clairvoyant, asks herself at one point, was it really better for human beings to pine to discover more of their past, or was it simply better to know as little of the past as possible and even forget what small amount was remembered?
Right.
Obviously, that resonates with the Turkish readership.
Yes, and I think it's an important question. The feeling I had while I was writing this book was perhaps it's better to have a mixture of memory and forgetfulness, because if you're too much memory-driven, then there's always the risk that you end up in a loop and keep repeating yourself. But obviously, forgetfulness is not good either. So maybe in the long run, what we need is a healthy mixture of both.
Do you agree with those people who think that the nationalists in Turkey brought charges against you and also, I guess, Orhan Pamuk and
right.
some other writers are really not so interested in halting this as in foiling attempts to join the EU?
Oh, absolutely. I very much agree. I don't think we were the main targets. We were the real targets there. The same group of ultranationalist lawyers brought charges against a series of writers, journalists, editors, publishers, sometimes even translators. But more than us, I think it's Turkey's EU membership that they're trying to attack, because they made it very clear that they're against Turkey's EU membership, which they see as some sort of slavery for the country.
So it's a good, it's good for them to go after prominent writers like you and Orhan Pamuk, because the world will take a lot more note than if you were some journalist who was writing for some obscure newspaper.
Sure, and it gives the whole country, you know, a bad image in the eyes of Westerners.
Meanwhile, you've sold 70,000 copies or so in Turkey.
This book sold 120,000, more than 120,000.
My information is old.
Yes.
Elif Shafak is has won a number of awards in Turkey for her novels. She's written six altogether, two in English, also a collection of essays. Mm-hmm. The most recent is The Bastard of Istanbul, and it is published by Viking.
Right.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.